Mr. Scorer.
Chair and panel, good afternoon. Our clients have asked me to begin by conveying their thanks to you for holding these hearings. For most of our clients, their experience of institutional response has been a very unhappy one. Our clients have appreciated the opportunity to be heard. They now hope very much that the evidence in these hearings will lead to real and lasting recommendations for change. With that in mind, the first issue I highlight is the lack of support our clients received from most of the institutions and agencies they had to deal with as a result of this abuse. With the exception of the police, where our clients' experiences were mainly positive, there was an unacceptable lack of support all the way through. Our client A299 was an impressive witness, but her composure when she gave evidence reflects her strength of character and family support. The school and others did little to support her. Our client A345, who was filmed by Jonathan Thompson Glover at Clifton College, told you that he received no support from the school at all. Mark Moore, the former head teacher, had a litany of excuses for this, and none were plausible. He said that the school was unaware of who the victims were, but there is no evidence that the school took steps to make past and present pupils aware of what support might be available should they be a victim. The same occurred at Headlands and Hillside. RSH1 told you that there was a complete lack of joined up communication between Hillside School, the local authority and the GP. H2 received no support when the serious case review was sent to her. Despite promises of improvement, the parole board's behaviour over Nigel Leet has been unacceptably poor. The attitude is that the victims are somebody else's problem. We urge you in your report to address the wider issue of lack of support for victims. As A345 said, where children are abused in school, a support package should be available. As A301 said, the Department for Education should take the lead in developing a protocol for this situation. We urge you to make clear in your report the responsibility of all bodies dealing with victims to take account of their rights and needs when making and implementing decisions. If that responsibility is to be met, it has to have some teeth. So we urge you to consider an enforceable duty on public bodies involved with victims of child sexual abuse to consider their needs when taking actions which might affect them. In the absence of this, there is an obvious risk that future victims will again find themselves completely unsupported. I then come to the issue of school inspections. In her opening, Ms. Scolding QC posed the question of whether inspection is adequate to identify safeguarding failures. The answer, quite plainly, is no. As seen repeatedly in this hearing and the previous one, and also in other strands of this inquiry, there were glowing inspection reports at the very time when serious abuse was happening in many of these schools. It is undeniable that the inspection system is repeatedly failing to pick this up and that this is a systemic problem. In our submission, Chair, three issues lie at the heart of this. As we heard, the inspection system is overwhelmingly geared towards academic performance. But it isn't just that the actual inspection itself focuses overwhelmingly on teaching. The issue is also that very few inspectors from the relevant agencies have meaningful experience of safeguarding. Inspectors are almost always experts in teaching, not safeguarding, and so they aren't equipped to focus on safeguarding, and therefore it gets sidelined. Ofsted say that pastoral concerns have been given greater weight since 2004, and they say that Stanbridge Earls was a turning point. However, we say that the lack of understanding of safeguarding in the inspection system was evident even this week. For example, Helen Humphreys from Ofsted was asked about how she goes about inspecting safeguarding. Her first answer was to say that she tries to find out how children feel. On one level, this is laudable, but anyone who knows anything about child abuse knows that asking a child how they feel will not result in a disclosure of abuse. You heard H1 explain that even though she was very close to her daughter denied that anything was wrong until she asked her directly whether Nigel Leet was touching her. Abused children are, of course, psychologically manipulated into not telling, and staff members who are committing abuse can deflect suspicion by expressing concerns about the victim. So talking to children may, in fact, tell you very little about whether something might be seriously wrong. Helen Humphreys is no doubt a very good inspector of teaching, but we feel that an informed safeguarding perspective, and indeed, as Mr. Frank alluded to, a victim-centred perspective, was lacking. And this aspect of the inspection system needs to change. The second issue relates to the manner in which inspections are carried out. Ms. Scolding asked Ofsted and ISI about the snapshot issue. To reiterate our point on that, teaching is going on all the time in a school. A snapshot approach of viewing a sample of lessons and coursework during the inspection is an entirely valid approach for assessing teaching. However, it is not a valid approach to inspecting safeguarding. There are far fewer safeguarding incidents in any school than there are lessons. The only effective way to inspect safeguarding is to critically interrogate everything that has happened at the school during the whole period since the last inspection and sometimes before that. This means, amongst other things, inspecting and reporting against all known DBS notifications, including police notifications, and against all referrals under the 2006 Act received since the last inspection, even if the relevant events occurred prior to that last inspection. And secondly, to critically examine and report on the safeguarding records throughout the whole of the inspection period. Every notification and referral, or the absence of such, might highlight a previously undetected shortcoming. Safeguarding incidents do not happen every day, and none might occur whilst the inspectors are present, and response to a safeguarding incident will play out over time. It is essential for inspectors to critically interrogate the records across the whole period to ensure that standards have been met consistently. Now, we say that at the very least, there is a lack of clarity on the part of inspecting agencies as to whether they do this, and just as importantly, as to whether they do it thoroughly. We'll deal with this in our written closing. But on the one hand, the Secretary of State claims that inspections are carried out by looking at the whole period. But on the other hand, in witness statements submitted to you, both Christine Ryan and Kate Richards refer to school inspection offering a snapshot, their word, of how a school is performing across a wide range of areas, including education and pupil welfare. As Kate Richards put it in her February 2018 statement, and I quote, "The purpose of inspection is to report on the extent to which the school is meeting the independent school standards at the time of inspection." So at the very least, there is uncertainty about the basis on which inspections are conducted. And with all due respect to the ISI witnesses, the precise detail of what they examine and, just as importantly, how much time they spend examining it wasn't really any clearer after their evidence this morning. The third issue, which was very obvious when you heard from Ofsted this week, is limitations on information. Inspectors are clearly only as good as the information available. Inspections are only as good as the information available to inspectors. As Amanda Spielman said, there is an enormous web of information that Ofsted can't currently tap into. And clearly in your report, you need to address the issues around GDPR and information sharing. But information can also clearly be deliberately withheld. Most parents would be absolutely staggered to hear Mr. Kennedy say, as he did this week, that you could have a situation where a teacher has been banned from teaching and inspectors, and I quote, might not necessarily know that because routinely we are not given that information. And we say that the government ministers you heard from on Wednesday were remarkably complacent about that situation. And they were also remarkably complacent, we would also say, about lack of consistency in the inspection system. We say that all children in all parts of the school system should be able to expect the same level of safeguarding. And we urge you in your report to reject the idea that the convenience of adults and their right to do something different is more important than the right of children to equal protection from abuse. Chair, as we've stressed before, the element that we believe needs to be present in order to underpin proper sharing of information between staff, schools, and local authorities is a legal requirement that all allegations and reasonable suspicions of abuse are reported. Clearly, in all three schools you've examined in this hearing, there have been serious failures to report allegations and reasonable suspicions to the LADO. In all three cases, there were lots of flashing red lights, and certainly at Hillside and Clifton, some more junior staff tried to sound the alarm. But at the senior leadership level in all three schools, there was a catastrophic failure to report the available information. Of course, all three schools now recognise that. At Clifton College, there has clearly been a big improvement in their approach to safeguarding. Mark Moore and Joe Newman are clearly poles apart in their grasp of safeguarding and their commitment to it. Mark Moore's first instinct when faced with a safeguarding crisis was not to bring in safeguarding expertise, it was to bring in a public relations firm. Unfortunately, that's a reaction which we've seen far too frequently in this inquiry, and we hope you'll be clear in your report in condemning the use of public relations firms to hide safeguarding failings. In contrast to Mr. Moore, Joe Newman's professionalism and commitment were very obvious. However, Clifton had little choice but to raise its game. It was, for example, struck off the Ministry of Defence recommended list. So the college had to take drastic action. But will the improvement be sustained if, for example, Joe Newman leaves for another school? In any case, lots of schools have not gone through the cathartic experience which Clifton went through. In this hearing, you heard from two individuals, Mark Moore and Christopher Hood, who were clearly completely unsuited to be head teachers. In schools around the country, there will be other Mark Moores and other Christopher Hoods. So you need to provide for all types of senior leadership behaviour. In listening to the evidence in this hearing, you saw the full range of reasons why people don't report abuse. Occasionally, there are deliberate cover-ups, and the overwhelming belief of our Hillside clients is that Christopher Hood knew perfectly well what Nigel Leake was doing and made a positive choice not to report it. However, even more common is that staff don't want to think badly of their colleagues or feel embarrassed about reporting. As Amanda Spielman said, reporting is always going to involve a degree of discomfort, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise. People worry, what if I'm wrong? Because we don't have mandatory reporting, many people see non-reporting of something as very much a lesser evil, even though the consequences can be disastrous. Mark Moore illustrated this attitude when he said that non-reporting was, as he put it, a sin of omission rather than commission. He saw non-reporting as something much less serious. So we come back to the point that the only thing that can capture all of these problems is a mandatory reporting law along the lines advocated by Mandate Now, namely a legal obligation to report knowledge or reasonable suspicion of abuse occurring within regulated activities and backed up by a criminal sanction. The Welsh model we heard about yesterday is not mandatory reporting and in our view cannot be relied upon to be effective because it has no legal teeth behind it. Of course, one of the other reasons identified for reluctance to report is a concern about false allegations. And you heard that concern expressed by the teaching unions. Chair, we've lodged with the inquiry the report from the DfE in 2008 on false allegations. And that identifies that false allegations of sexual abuse constitute only a very small percentage of all allegations against teachers. However, even though research shows that to be the reality, it is understandable that teaching unions will be concerned about this issue. On this particular point, we say that mandatory reporting would actually be helpful. The problem at the moment is that schools have a discretion as to whether to report an allegation or suspicion to the LADO. Because they have a discretion, when they do report, this can be seen as signifying that they consider the allegation or suspicion to be true. The exercise of discretion implies that the school is making a judgment about the strength of the evidence. However, if we had a mandatory reporting law, then the reporting of a matter to the LADO would become, in fact, a genuinely neutral notification. It would not carry the implication that the allegation is necessarily true. So we say that contrary to the understandable fears of the teaching unions, mandatory reporting brings that neutrality into the situation, to the benefit of all concerned. And also a statutory duty to report protects the person reporting from defamation claims, removing a major source of the what if I'm wrong worry. I make one other point on mandatory reporting. There's been talk in these hearings about introducing a duty of candour similar to the NHS. We say that this is nothing like enough and there is no evidence of the duty of candour making a meaningful difference in the health service. On the contrary, research published in the Health Service Journal identified an ongoing failure by NHS Trust to adhere to the duty and a failure by the CQC also to enforce it. The only thing in our view and survivors' view which would realistically have ensured that the concerns about Nigel Leake were passed on to the LADO would have been a mandatory reporting duty backed up by criminal sanctions for failure to report. And even if Christopher Hood didn't forward concerns to the LADO himself in breach of such a law, junior staff could have bypassed him safe in the knowledge that they were complying with a legal duty. Chair, finally on recommendations, we said in the previous hearing in this strand that there needs to be far more consistency amongst LADOs. You heard from Nicola Laird, who is clearly an outstanding LADO, but there is no formal accreditation requirement for LADOs across the country. And we strongly urge you as part of your final report to make recommendations for the training and accreditation of LADOs and a structured system of rules for their work. LADOs are, of course, a crucial part of the chain, and even if you recommend mandatory reporting, as we hope you will, its benefits will only be felt fully if the performance of some LADOs improves. So, Chair, these are our recommendations on behalf of victims and survivors. Too many schools currently have undetected poor safeguarding which abusers can exploit, and in some cases are probably exploiting right now without our knowledge. Survivors feel that without these reforms, nothing will really change. We urge you to ensure that this inquiry is the means by which real change is brought about. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scorer.